Podrick, get in here.
I'm standing right here, Your Vice Majesty.
So you are. Any news of me out on the streets?
Not that I am aware of, Your Royal Second-in-Command.
Nothing in the scrolls, banners, broadsides, pieces of paper stuck to ravens? No mention of Associate Queen Kyon Wolf, Deputy Warden of the Seven Kingdoms, Auxiliary Protector of the Realm, Second Banana of the First Men, Vice Castellan of the Dreadfort on Clegane? No?
I had not heard that last one, m'lady.
I made it up. What else have I to do all day? No one knows I exist. Who is King Joffrey beheaded today?
A documentary crew from the Stormlands, Your Vice Majesty.
I need my own initiative, something more popular than the Dragon Core testing standards. Those did not go over well.
People threw excrement into the streets from the highest windows.
You always bring that up. What does King Joffrey do with the heads he cuts off?
Puts them on pikes, m'lady.
How about if we composted them? That idea should come from my office, and it's very green, right? And we can get the schools involved. Compost the heads, make it part of food production. It's the circle of life. We need a cute name.
Project Noggin?
I love Project Noggin.
Should we run this by King Joffrey?
Oh, you know, he's so busy. And I really want this to come from me. What's the worst that could happen? Meanwhile, let's listen to the show about Hillary Clinton, Veep, and the great tournament everyone's watching. And now he's slated to star in the upcoming Elbridge Gerry biopic, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, when I first heard there was a TV series called Veep, I just assumed it was about Elbridge Gerry. I was shocked when it was not, because there's so much tremendous real estate to be explored there. I mean, you even got your own creature named after you. All right, so let me tell you what's going to happen on the show today. In a little while, towards the end of the show, we are going to visit both with Steve Eder from the New York Times, who's a reporter specializing kind of in NCAA issues, and Dama Moore from the Hartford Current, because they're all down there in Texas where the basketball thing is happening. But here on The Scramble, we always try to begin with what we call a super guest. Well, could we get a more super guest than Frank Rich? We always ask the super guest to bring his own topics or her own topics. Frank Rich is writer-at-large for New York Magazine and executive producer of the aforementioned HBO series Veep, which started season 3 last night. So we're going to talk to Frank about a bunch of things. We're going to start with his article in the current issue, right now on the stands, probably won't get it in your mailbox for a day or two, of New York Magazine. It's called Scandal Loves a Clinton. And a little bit later, we'll talk about Veep. If we have time, we'll talk about the plight of Brendan Eich, a former head of Mozilla. And although I didn't really brief or prepare Frank for this, we might have to say a word or two about Mickey Rooney. I'm guessing Frank Rich has something to say about Mickey Rooney. Anyway, Frank Rich, welcome to the show.
Great to talk to you again, Colin.
It's great to talk to you as well. So we're going to begin with the Clinton article.
Now,
the thesis of the Clinton article is it's kind of like The Blob, the 1950s science fiction movie. I think the idea of The Blob was that every time you shot a missile or something into it, the blob got stronger. And you're kind of making a comparable argument about the Clintons and about Hillary Clinton, that if, in fact, Republican operatives try to revive, as they've already done, old, for the most part, sexually based scandal accusations against the Clintons, it will, in fact, make them stronger rather than weaker. Elaborate.
Absolutely. Well, as some may recall, those with long memories, I realize here in America we don't often remember anything, but in the 1990s, when the Clinton sex scandals broke, it kept the opposition, mainly Republicans, kept assuming that the Clintons would go away, Bill Clinton in particular in those days, and then were stunned when over and over again, every time there was some bombshell development about a sex scandal in particular, and particularly Monica Lewinsky, his poll numbers would go up and indeed reached levels that have not been seen in years at the height of impeachment as he was being put on trial essentially for lying about an illicit a sex act. And what's fascinating to me this year is that, as the idea of a Hillary Clinton candidacy seems more and more likely to people. Of course, we don't know yet if she's running, but there seems to be actually no opposition within the Democratic Party to speak of. The Republicans, as you said, some of the operatives are already putting it out there. Oh, we don't want to go back to Monica Lewinsky again. And they don't seem to remember what happened last time and it will happen again. Furthermore, what really complicates it for the Republicans now is this war on women idea that came about in the last election with all this talk about contraception and so-called legitimate rape. The whole anger about the Clintons over sex ends up being another war on women, or in this case, a war on one woman, Hillary Clinton, because they just can't help themselves. So if they bring Bill Clinton's sex life into the or his past sex life into the campaign, inevitably there'll be a misogynistic, sexist quality to it, as there was last time around. Hillary Clinton was often insulted as a really an innocent bystander in her husband's sex scandal, and we'll see that happen again, and it will just backfire on the Republicans even more so, I suspect.
You know, reading your article and then realizing that we were also going to be talking about Veep, I also wondered whether the Republicans quite understood the cultural moment they're in now, even at the level of pop culture. And I think I had several thoughts about this. One of them is that I don't really watch this show, but my significant other does. But my understanding of the entire point of the show, The Good Wife, is that one survives this horrible, very Clinton-esque looking sexual political scandal. And if one is the wronged woman in that scandal, one grows stronger from it. And one is almost empowered to do more, you know, and maybe even to push certain envelopes and cross certain lines because you've grown from this and you can point to injustices directed to you in the past, and people are kind of happy to see you prosper. Go ahead.
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, that comes across clearly in The Good Wife, and I think that's what came across in the previous Clinton era, even though the conservatives couldn't believe it. There was a fascinating panel some years back, but around the time Hillary Clinton was running for Senate in New York at the AEI, the conservative think tank, and Lynn Cheney said in that panel, "What I really can't stand about Hillary Clinton is that she goes around as if she's in a happy marriage." First of all, the idea that anyone knows what goes on in anyone else's marriage is itself ludicrous. But secondly, I think it played in. She couldn't understand how Hillary Clinton might be empowered by scandal, that she might have come to some reckoning in her personal life that was positive out of a potentially horrible or, you know, difficult marital situation. And I think that's entirely true. And then you add, in the current culture, which wasn't true so much last time, a culture that just moved so much further on women's issues as it has on other issues, and everything about the Republican Party seems so antediluvian. I mean, they can't even, you know, rally around fair pay laws for women or women violence against women legislation to top it all off with sort of a demeaning attitude towards someone who's been the Secretary of State as well as a senator and First Lady about her husband and about sex is just, I think, going to be toxic.
Just back to the AEI panel, there's sort of a strange irony, too, that these days, at least publicly, the Clintons get along a lot better than the Cheneys do.
Exactly. And also in the case of Lynn Cheney, she in essence disowned the marriage of her own child. So who is she to talk? Of course, none of that had happened.
Yeah, that was waiting for them in the future when she spoke.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, just sort of back to this whole question of how women are perceived in political combat and how what kind of Republican rhetoric gets directed at them. It does strike me that there are some differences between the perception of Hillary Clinton and the way other women are often talked about. And, you know, your article made me realize that one of the new tripwire words is emotional. So Bridget Kelly, who's a figure in the Bridgegate, New Jersey Chris Christie story, and as you pointed out in that report, she was explained by her emotions and her subjective motivation and her state of mind and this whole idea that this prior romantic relationship with one of the other participants had just unhorsed her and made her into this irrational, crazy bridge-closing person. And we even saw it over the weekend with the former CIA director saying that Dianne Feinstein had deep emotional feelings that may have, you know, may turned her off towards torture, you know, as opposed to the rest of us who enjoy torture because we don't let our emotions get in the way.
Right.
But, you know, for Hillary, of course, the struggle 4 years ago was to evince emotions, right? When she cried in New Hampshire, that was really – it was a huge plus for her because people needed to see that.
Exactly. In fact, it's something that we use in the first season of Veep for our heroine to when she needed to some sympathy of sort. Not that I'm saying that Hillary Clinton put it on. I don't believe she did. I think she was, you know, who knows. But anyway, yeah, well, now Hillary Clinton, I think because of her period at state is, and also in some ways because of the overall lasting image of her 2008 campaign, the, you know, the 3 a.m. phone call and the sort of the crying incident notwithstanding, the kind of you know, I'll go into a Pennsylvania blue-collar bar and knock back some beers. That whole image positioning has kind of taken the emotional component out of the, you're right, out of the public image. It's a very shrewd observation. Of course, all this could turn on a dime.
Yes, things do change. Well, you know, another pop culture TV thought I had that was a nice bridge from this to Veep is reading your article is, you know, you take us back to the time when there were people like Rush Limbaugh openly trafficking in the notion that, for example, Hillary Clinton and Vince Foster had an affair and then he was murdered to cover up this affair, which, by the way, in terms of damage control, seems like, you know, would have been poor thinking anyway. But the people who believe that or who throw it out there are essentially trafficking also in the notion that we see in things like House of Cards and Scandal, that there is this Washington where there are horrible things that happen and then there's highly competent fixers who are able to come along and clean up the mess. Whereas what I know about Washington, I mean, oddly enough, I mean, comedies are not supposed to be more realistic than dramas. But, I mean, the world of Veep, which is full of incompetent lickspittles and you know, toadies and people who are far, far overreaching their own abilities in terms of their aspirations, seems like a much more gritty, realistic portrait of Washington.
I think so. And I've thought about it a lot because besides covering Washington, I grew up there. And as I discovered early on, Julia Louis-Dreyfus also grew up there, which is something I didn't know until we started working together on this 3.5 years ago. And we both reflected a lot on why this is so much more accurate to us. And I think part of it is it's entirely written by Brits, and they have they're political junkies. You know, they read Robert Caro's books on Johnson, they read Politico, they know what's going on, but they're watching it generally from London, except when we're in Baltimore shooting the show, and they have an objectivity and a lack of sentimentality about it, and so they kind of see it in a way that somehow. It's hard to do, you know, House of Cards even, leaving aside, you know, the murder and the murderous aspects and the kind of really, you know, sort of the criminal aspects, really also has a somewhat romantic view of Washington. It's not the West Wing, which had a very romantic view, but it's still, it's kind of glossy, it's kind of glamorous, even if horrible things are happening. One of the first things Armando Iannucci, the creator of Veep, did at the very beginning before we shot anything was he sent a memo to the production designers and he said, look, this should not look like, you know, an American president or movies like that. It should look the way it really is. It's detritus and garbage all around. The chairs don't match the desks. The offices are you know, filthy. He said that, you know, everyone dresses 10 years behind New York in terms of fashion, except for one character, Dan Egan, the Reed Scott sort of go-getter in The Office. He's 3 years ahead of everyone else in fashion, which means he's 7 years behind New York. And in the show itself, I think this is really true, and having grown up around these people, the permanent sort of bureaucracy of federal government, they were, you know, the kids I went to school, these were their parents. It's about the most minor power plays. It's about getting ahead. We had a joke in the pilot that ended up on the cutting room floor where it really had people fighting over an outlet to recharge a cell phone. And who was closer to the outlet became a power grab in the vice president's office. That's the permanent way of Washington. And we may go through periods of particularly explosive dysfunction, as we have in recent years. But this kind of shambling incompetence and you know, people stabbing each other in the back and fighting over the most minor details for their own self-aggrandizement is unfortunately the way of the world down there. And we've been struck by how many actual Washington workers, people in the federal government, in congressional offices, or in, for that matter, the West Wing, feel that our show gets it.
I mean, I find myself thinking a lot about Veep versus reality and ways in which something like Veep can help you understand reality, including, I still don't understand this, and this tracks us back towards Hillary. It's another kind of bridge between the two things. But I've never quite exactly understood what Huma Abedin, the wife of Anthony Weiner, does for Hillary Clinton. But my sense in just reading about it and being told about it and asking questions about it is for much of her time there, although she's often often portrayed as this incredibly hyper-competent, super cerebral kind of person, which she may very well be.
Right.
But her job has basically, for most of the time, been body man, right? She's been
like Tony Hale.
She's Tony Hale. She's Gary. Yeah.
In our show, yes. We're speculating here, and I'm sure she. Obviously, she's
she's smarter than Gary.
Competent person, but no, it's about being a sycophant and about making sure that the right document is in her boss's hands, or in Gary's case, in our show, you know, the right. Purell or whatever it is in any given moment. And it's true. And by the way, we've had this experience, every member of the cast has and everyone on the show, where if you're in a Washington setting and you're meeting people from the Hill, without any embarrassment, they'll say, "Oh, I'm the Jonah in my office and and she's the Amy and he's the Gary." And indeed, we at the end of the first season, we had a rap party in Baltimore. We shoot, as does House of Cards, we shoot in Baltimore for various reasons with exteriors in Washington. And a prominent politician who should remain nameless decided to come to the rap party. And he was with a couple of aides. And we're howling because they're behaving exactly like our characters. "Oh, would you like another beer? And, you know, please stand this way, you know, because the camera's coming at you this way." You can't make this stuff up, really.
You know, I think we're also at the point of what Brooke Breathed, the cartoonist, once referred to as the difficulty of successfully offending anybody. Because I right when the series started, I was at a wedding, and I was at a wedding with a guy who was just coming off a stint as a body man for a former vice president. And he said, "Oh, no, that's pretty much the way it is. That's why we like it so much."
Yes.
They're not offended by it. I don't know if you've succeeded in offending anybody.
That's a very good point. I'm not sure. Well, it's interesting. The very first season, a couple of journalists or reviewers, but Washington journalists who wrote about the show, who remain nameless, like Eleanor Cliff, for instance, wrote aggrieved pieces about how cynical the show was, and there's nothing, you know, this is not the way it really works. So a few people were offended at the beginning, but then I think they threw in the towel. And maybe they started to laugh. And indeed, I don't think we're offending people, not even with the language in the show, which is we can't use here, but which is, by the standards even of perhaps cable television, quite something in terms of eschatology.
Just one last thing before we take a break here, and it's just a swing back to the article Scandal Loves a Clinton, which will appear in your current issue of New York Magazine. We're talking to Frank Rich, the writer-at-large, editor-at-large for New York Magazine, who wrote it, and executive producer of Veep. You know, there's one phrase in there that I think is you could do an entire separate essay about this. You refer to the – because I'm not sure whether I agree with it or not, but I'm really intrigued by it. You say that the Clintons now are sort of regarded as national grandparents. You know, one of them is going to be about 68, 69. The other one's going to be about 70 as the – this political season unfolds. And, you know, I wonder whether that's true just because they also are – they so epitomize the baby boom generation. And the entire ethos of the baby boom generation, as far as I can tell as a member of it, is one is an adolescent until about 5 minutes before one dies.
Well, and so as a fellow member of the generation, I know where you're coming from. And you may be right. I think, though, it won't be – the Clintons' generation, it won't be our generation that will be looking at them this way. It'll be, I hate to say this, so many people younger than us who are going to vote, some of whom, of course, did the math, some of whom would not have been born at the time the Lewinsky scandal broke, incredibly enough, in 2016. I think I really meant it more towards them.
Well, that makes sense, yeah.
Not our fading, sad, aging boomer generation.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll have a little bit more of time with Frank Rich, which is great. So we'll be back.
To the prom with me, to the prom with Hillary Clinton. Will you go to the prom with me? To the prom with me, to the prom with Hillary Clinton. Will you go, will you go, will you go? Oh, will you go to the prom with me?
All right, we're back. We've got about 5 more minutes here with Frank Rich before he has to go, so we'll read through 2 quick topics here. One of them is Brendan Eich. He is was the CEO of Mozilla. It turned out that a few years ago, in 2008, he'd given $1,000 to an anti-gay marriage campaign, part of Proposition 8, didn't seem to matter while he was chief technical officer of Mozilla. When he became CEO, though, everything changed, and he was forced out by, as Slate magazine reported, a combination of internal unrest and public condemnation. Frank Rich, I've been reading all kinds of things about this, ranging from Frank Bruni to Andrew Sullivan, and I feel right now I'm committing the pundit's sin of not really exactly knowing 100% where I come down on one side of the line or the other. It's a little bit complicated for me. Where are you on this?
Yeah, I've been reading what you have and also been thinking about it, and I guess I have come to a position, and my feeling is that it's a little murky, as I understand it, whether he was pushed or left on his own. But the fact is that if his doing this, giving $1,000 to Proposition 8, made it untenable for him to be a successful CEO with his workforce at Mozilla or with the outside world Mozilla has to deal with as a very prominent, obviously, digital internet operation, he couldn't go on. I do think, I know that Andrew Sullivan and some others have made a big point about this is, you know, he's entitled to free speech, and of course he is. And I do think, though, there is a distinction between, say, having you can be against same-sex marriage and not necessarily be a bigot, I guess, and you can have an opinion about it, which is heartfelt, that for religious reasons or other reasons, you're against it. Although, of course, Americans are by the droves changing in this, you know, every day. What makes this, I think, unsavory and not quite as simple as that is he gave $1,000 to a truly ugly and really homophobic campaign against it wasn't just against same-sex marriage. The Proposition 8 campaign, as it actually played out in California, was really about bigotry. It was presenting gay people in general as dangerous to society, dangerous to children and other families in particular, and he gave money to finance that. And that's quite different from just saying I'm against same-sex marriage for whatever reason. But tell me if you disagree. That's sort of where I've come down on it.
Yeah, I mean, I lean that way. I'm just sort of in the process of, I mean, obviously, as you say, there have been just massive changes telescoped into this tiny period of time that I never would have guessed. And I'm,
right.
I'm gratified by these changes. And I guess I'm unsure about how quickly I or anybody else has a right to expect the rest of the world to catch up and change and understand. But the point you make that the tenor of the campaign he supported, you know, I mean, I even look at it, you know, do I have to, how outraged do I have to be at any Mormon I meet? You know, I want to be able to think okay thoughts about certain Mormons anyway.
Right. I think that's fair. And by the way, and I would agree with you there, except the Mormon Church, of course, was also, I think, owes an apology for the fact that it poured a ton of money into that that same ugly campaign.
Yep.
In fact, they were, I think, the single biggest, through various means, economic sponsors of it, financial backers of it. One thing about this guy is that he never really said anything publicly about it.
Right.
I don't know why he didn't. Why didn't he say, this is my heartfelt opinion, maybe that campaign was over the top, and looking back in retrospect, I shouldn't have helped, you know, underwrite commercials that presented gay people as, you know, horror movie figures. But for whatever reason, and I don't know if I know the answer. Maybe you've read something. I haven't on this.
Didn't. Even Selena's team could have come up with something for him to say.
Exactly. It would have compounded the problem, but at least they would have come up with something.
Okay, so Frank Rich, 2 minutes left for you.
Sure.
Mickey Rooney died at the age of 93, had a great run. He's sort of he was one of the last remaining bridges to, like, everything, you know? I mean, two real comedies and vaudeville and silent movies. But I don't know, what jumps into your mind?
Well, you know, I recommend to everyone, there's no one who writes better about old Hollywood than Algene Harmetz, the retired New York Times Hollywood reporter who did contribute the obituary that the Times has up today about Mickey Rooney. And there's so much that's poignant about it. I mean, this guy was incredibly self-destructive, had a crazy personal life in terms of his marital history, in terms of, you know, squandering money and gambling and all sorts of other things, and did everything in show business. I mean, he was successful in movies, television, Broadway near the end of his career, was still working, and was nuts, obviously. But it's just an amazing story. It's almost a Dickensian story. And one detail that I didn't know that I read in Algene's obit is that I knew that he was from a show business family, and his father was a sort of second-tier vaudevillian, and his mother was like a burlesque or vaudeville chorus girl, and they split up when he was very, very young, and they had $40 between them, and each got $20. That's the kind of poverty and broken home he was born into, and how this guy survived in 93 and with just terrible setbacks, some of them self-perpetuated, to be sure, and did some fantastic work. I mean, you know, some of his work, both as a child, as an adolescent in the Judy Garland movies, as an adult, and as a more serious actor, as a clown on Broadway, is some of the best work American pop culture has ever seen, and holds up completely. And to contrast that with the life that produced it, well, I wish someone would write a real biography of him. He wrote his own autobiography that was not, I don't think, entirely honest or complete over 20 years ago with the title Life is Too Short.
Right, exactly. And I have to say, watching the battle, having just watched the battle between the Colbert Report and activist Suey Park, I keep thinking, wow, I keep thinking about Breakfast at Tiffany's, which really is an inappropriate Asian stereotype character. Talk about how times change.
Times change, but he did it. He threw himself into anything.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I'm sure he probably did blackface at some point in his career. There's nothing he didn't do. It's just an amazing amazing story.
Frank Rich, so great to talk to you. We love your work in New York Magazine, of course. And
great to talk to you always, Colin.
All right. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks.
Bye. All right. We'll take a break. We'll be back after this.
What a good man you're getting in me.
no elk or mason or woodman who gets home at three. The girls who see me grow soft and dreamy, but I'm a gander who won't philander. Oh, could you use me? 'Cause I certainly could use you.
I didn't find last night's episode particularly funny. The one where Millard Fillmore helps President Zachary Taylor keep William Seward off the cabinet. Although it's possible I was watching the wrong Veep series. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our intern Skylar Magnoli. Greg Hill appeared in the introduction and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Talarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Tony Hale. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff performing musical numbers from Babes on Broadway, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, our salute to Spite. And now, back to Colin.
And before we plunge into this segment, too, I want to remind you, because we're going to be talking about sports, and by Wednesday, all of the college basketball excitement will be over, but you'll want to sustain it somehow. So you'll come to Watkinson School at 7 p.m., where Jeff Jacobs from the Hartford Current and a bunch of other panelists, including Reggie Hatchett, the coach of Weaver, somebody from the Corey Stringer Institute, and also someone with a background in youth sports. We're all going to have a conversation there as part of the Freshly Squeezed series at Watkinson School about sort of what kinds of messages about sports are sent from the highest levels of sports right down to the playing fields that youth competitors play on. And so if you have questions, if you're a parent of somebody playing youth sports, if you feel like the sport that you love has kind of gotten off track somehow, it'll be a great place for you to come. We'd love to have you there. And so please call Watkinson School or go on their website, watkinson.org, to get your tickets. We do need to give you a ticket or get a ticket into your hands so that you can come. There's a small charge that actually goes to support three local nonprofits. So join us for that, 7 p.m. Wednesday night. All right, so what is everybody talking about in Connecticut? Obviously, the NCAA tournament. We've got two UConn teams competing for championships. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking in particular about the men's tournament. Joining us in just a second is Dom Amore, a colleague of Jeff Jacobs's and one of the people contributing fine coverage of the tournament and of the UConn Huskies to the Hartford Current. We're going to start with Steve Eder from the New York Times. He writes about sort of issues affecting NCAA athletes and also had a great read this morning about how an institution like the University of Connecticut takes a moment like this where donors are all flocking down from Connecticut, down to Texas, and their brains are bathed in the endorphins that come with basketball success and are therefore even more likely to open up their wallets. So, Steve Eder, can we just start there? The article that you wrote was very interesting, talking about President Susan Herbst and the rest of her team and the way in which they really, this party that's going on, this basketball-themed party going on down there, can be really good in terms of filling the coffers of the university.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I spent some time on Saturday when the men's basketball team was getting ready to play, and all through the Final Four game, sort of seeing the president of Connecticut, Susan Herbst, in action, and so some of that involved interaction with donors, with fans, with alums, and it was an interesting look. I mean, the schools go out of their way when they're participating in an event like this to really take advantage of it. You know, that means providing opportunities for donors to get on the flight, to get good seats, to get to stay at the hotel, which provides an audience with key people from the university to talk to them about donations.
And it is, it's hard. It's easier to ask somebody for money when they're incredibly happy, and people tend to get very happy around basketball success like this. And so that the idea of providing even more money, I think it's. I mean, people are almost neurologically wired to do that in a situation like this.
Yeah, and you see this all over the country. Other schools will do the same. This is when Connecticut's men's team won on Saturday night. I mean, immediately it's an opportunity where you've got two more days of being in a confined space with very, very happy UConn supporters. So two more days of work for some of the executives over at the university to talk with these folks about what they might be willing to donate and what projects they have going on. And they're feeling good about the school right now, certainly.
Now, this moment is a moment where a lot of the issues that you cover as part of your beat all kind of bubble up at once. And you've got Mark Emmert, who's the president of the NCAA, and I might add a former chancellor of the University of Connecticut, who's kind of on the spot about a lot of this stuff, but also trying to talk constructively about it, ranging from this nascent and really kind of surprising unionization movement to the whole question of one-and-done players who come in and just play for 1 year and go into the NBA, which is very much the case with Kentucky. So maybe we just take a couple of those things. The union thing has gotten really interesting, right? It's not just the Northwestern football team anymore. It's really an entire class of college athletes who seem eager to talk about this one way or another.
It's a huge topic. The union decision, you know, so far in terms of, you know, the nuts and bolts of this thing is that a regional director of the NLRB said the Northwestern football team at a private school could proceed with trying to get a union in place, that they were actually employees as opposed to the student athlete term. It's a narrow decision that has large ramifications. There's still a long way to go in terms of appeals and all that, but it's sort of provided this moment for renewed discussion. I mean, we've been talking about lawsuits against the NCAA and the conferences for quite some time, you know, but here at the moment where you're sort of seeing students and recent former students outlining the kinds of things that they want to see changed at the NCAA level to accommodate today's athletes.
This is Steve Eder with the New York Times. He's with us. I want to add to this conversation Dom Amore. Dom spends a lot of time alongside these athletes. Dom Amore from the Hartford Current, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Colin. Thanks for having me.
You know, and I was reading in the Connecticut Mirror today that Shabazz Napier, who, of course, is the star guard for the University of Connecticut, had told reporters that he understands the unionization movement at Northwestern and that he sometimes has to go to bed starving because he can't afford food. I mean, we really sort of think of college athletes, especially big stars like Shabazz Napier, as these cosseted people whose every whim is there's a rush to grant it. So it's kind of striking to hear him say this. Are you hearing UConn basketball players in general talk in maybe a slightly different way about these issues?
Well, not different from other schools, Colin. I mean, Shabazz has said that numerous times through the years. In fact, he said it quite a bit during Ryan Boatwright's issues with the NCAA, that the NCAA could be a little bit too rigid with some of the rules that it has. And, you know, the thing you have to realize is that the athletes come to schools, but, you know, many of them, you know, come from, you know, underprivileged backgrounds, and, you know, their tuition's covered and their expenses are covered, but, you know, their main living expenses, you know, are not, and so they don't actually have money, you know, in their pocket, and that's where, you know, I think there's no easy way around it, because once you go down the route of paying athletes a stipend, then you could actually find, you know, schools bidding against each other with the stipend as part of the recruiting process. It's got to be governed in common sense ways. But I do think that some things have to change. And certainly, whether a union in the same sense of unions as we know it is the answer, or some type of organization that stands up for the rights of the athletes, I think it's an idea whose time may have come.
Well, you know, Steve Eder from the New York Times, to that point, I mean, one of the things we hear Mark Emmert saying is, first of all, a little bit, I mean, I don't understand these issues all that well. It's a little bit surprising to me to hear the NCAA president talking about a plan that would almost make the NCAA less relevant than it is now. But he seems to be talking about loosening things up and giving athletic conferences more control over their own destiny. But to Dom's point, doesn't that set up a situation where if, in fact, the rules and the sort of the built-in compensation, if we can even use that word, if it's better at the Big Ten than in, you know, the AAC, don't you also then set up this the kind of thing that Dom's talking about, but at least directed at conferences? Why would I go play in one conference if another conference has a better deal for me?
Well, sure. I mean, that's where this issue is going to start to play out. It sounds like in the next few weeks, and then months down the road here. You know, the issue that we're all discussing is that there's a plan right now that's being worked on at the NCAA level, and, you know, which is hundreds and hundreds of members, you know, some big wealthy types of schools, some not so much. And the idea that's being put forth is to let what they call the five well-resourced conferences sort of have some ability to say, this is, these are some, you know, quality of life things we'd like to be able to do for our athletes. And some of that could involve a stipend, it could involve health care things, it could involve limited practice time. There's some different things, but it'd give them what they kept using the word autonomy yesterday. You're going to see as that goes forward, there's a recognition, I think, at the NCAA level, certainly at, from Emmert and some of the other leaders, that there needs to be some sort of change. But the issue that you're identifying is something that people are also talking about, that, okay, well, we have these, what if you're not in these five conferences? How does that work for you? How would it work for a school like Connecticut, which would be on the outside of that?
And we may talk to Dom a little bit about that whole question of Connecticut's conference position going forward in just a second. But Steve Eder, while we have you, one last area I wanted to get into with you, because you've been writing about it a lot, and I guess it didn't even occur to me until I read your article, that even the ladder that they climb up on to cut down the nets at these things is a product placement ladder with a specific ladder name, that I should want to go out and buy this step ladder because I just subconsciously remember seeing it somewhere, that there's so much money saturating this process. And so that's sort of the other thing. I mean, it's kind of part of the conversation that we're having right now about unionization, but just, you know, all these lawsuits that are making their way through the court right now about athletes, even athletes who aren't in college anymore, still benefiting from the commercialization and the use of their images.
Yeah, I mean, the issues you're bringing up that were in the story that you did the other day, I mean, it's nothing new that this conference has a lot of commercial sponsors, corporate sponsors. It's, you know, very visible in the professional leagues. It's visible at the Olympics. And it's nothing new to this tournament this year. But I think the reason it's being discussed and people are pointing out the Powerade Cups and things like that is because of all these other issues that are in the backdrop right now, the lawsuits, the union effort. There's a real sensitivity to this. So it's kind of created a moment where, you know, we're looking at these things and saying, okay, there's all this commercialization here, and what does that mean? What does that say about where this conference is and what should be happening as it relates to these athletes and potential ways of including them in that?
All right, Steve Eder, great coverage. We've really been enjoying it. Thank you so much for joining us today, and people should jump on the New York Times website and read back three or four articles, because all these things are going to come to a head in the weeks ahead. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. And we're going to turn over to Dom Amore, who's been covering the team for the Hartford Current. So, Dom Amore, let's talk storylines for a second here. I mean, we've had sort of a David versus Goliath storyline for the UConn team with a lot of the teams that they've played. They've been higher seeded. The expectations have been bigger. Now they're playing for a championship against Kentucky. It's a 7 seed playing an 8 seed. I mean, how does the storyline play out now? Is there a clear favorite?
Well, I think Kentucky is, again, the clear favorite, and the reason they are is because they're not your typical number 8 seed. They were actually the top-ranked team in the country before the season started because of the much-heralded freshman class that they brought in. It's one of the most highly regarded recruiting classes ever. But, you know, as part of the process of operating that way, they struggled during the regular season. They struggled to find their inexperience. They lost a lot more games than people thought, and when they went into the tournament, they were a number 8 seed. But now, you know, they're really not freshmen anymore. They have a whole season behind them. They have a lot of experience. They're getting better before our eyes as you watch them. And so, really, probably more so than UConn, because it's an experienced team that is what it is. You know, Kentucky is really a much, much different team than it was a month ago. So for most people, we consider them the clear favorite strictly on the raw talent that they have.
You know, in terms of storyline also, as you look at UConn, it really is like what a difference a day makes. UConn has gone from having a pretty negative storyline a season or two ago and obviously inability to complete in postseason play because of academic problems, low graduation rate, blah, blah, blah. We know the whole thing. They've gone from that almost overnight to, in this storyline, the school that has the seniors who stayed the whole way, people like Shabazz Napier who are going to graduate, as opposed to Kentucky, which has a pretty cynical-looking one-and-done approach. A lot of these freshmen are going to jump from here to the NBA. It's pretty startling that UConn's in the position it is in terms of having kind of a high moral ground.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, in baseball, the best way to look like the good guys is probably to play the Yankees, right? And and it's kind of like that when you're playing Kentucky. Yeah, you know, I think UConn was in the process of getting its act together on this front, a lot of its fronts, a few years ago. But on the way the NCAA works and the way the process works, you know, and I'm not sure that there's any other way that it can work. You know, you're going to see the results of the preceding classes. I mean, you can't necessarily look at the present. You have to look at the 4 or 5 year rolling average, and to do that, you have to go back 4, 5, and 6 years. So, you know, their academic numbers were low, their graduation rate was low, but that reflects really classes that began 9 or 10 years ago and either graduated or didn't graduate 4 or 5 years ago. So this class is an outstanding class in the sense that all four of the seniors are going to graduate on time. One of them is a grad student who transferred in, but Shabazz Napier, Neil Skafai, Tyler Oleander, they all played the 4 years and they're going to graduate on time. And even the juniors on this team, if they do choose to leave a year early, they are well on the way to, they're ahead of schedule. So it would be a relatively easy process for them to complete their degree if they wanted to. But, you know, it's a lot of it's the system, a lot of it's the way it works, that Kentucky's able to get these one-and-done players in. But as long as they complete that spring semester and then sign a pro contract, it doesn't count against their APR score, the way that system works. They kind of circumvent the system a little bit. So there's a little bit of an illusion there. You're right. But Kentucky, the way they operate, does leave a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. There's no question about that. And it puts UConn in a, you know, comparatively speaking, in a favorable light. But I think also UConn has, you know, Kevin Ollie has brought extraordinary stability and has done a tremendous job replacing the guy that he replaced, Jim Calhoun. And I think that also, you know, makes them kind of an easy team for people to root for.
I agree. I've gradually fallen in love with them, and these two senior guards, Boatwright and Napier. And, you know, when you watch it on television, the camera pans up to their moms. I assume this is the story of two single mothers who've raised two very mature young guys who are really putting on a great show right now for their university. And I kind of like that, too. I think it's sort of a heartwarming story. Just real quickly, Dom, how do you think we match up tonight?
I think I'm through picking against UConn. I mean, I didn't think they were going to beat Michigan State. I didn't think they would beat Florida. So I'm through with that. I think that Kentucky, although they've played extremely well, they are still freshmen. And I think the possibility that UConn will throw some things at them that they have not seen before is very great. And I think you may find themselves turning the ball over quite a bit. So I like UConn in this matchup. I mean, I think Kentucky probably has much more raw talent, size, speed, skill. But I think, UConn may throw a few things at them that they haven't seen before and may be able to take control of the game by doing that.
Yeah, I after the Florida game, really, and seeing how well UConn adjusted and how well UConn took advantage of adjustments that Florida made, you've got to like it. I'm sure a lot of UConn fans would have rather played Wisconsin, because there's something about this Kentucky team, because they're so young and so physically gifted, do get the feeling that if they get hot, particularly from the threes, they may be really hard to stop, even if you're playing good defense.
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, Kentucky probably plays the style that UConn would rather play. I think UConn would rather play a more wide open, up and down the floor, full court game. That's what Kentucky can do, but Kentucky may have the athletes to actually beat UConn at that game, whereas other teams like Michigan State or Wisconsin would have done, probably try to trap UConn into a slower half-court game, which is not really UConn's bag. So
I think
the game is going to be played to the pace that UConn would like. But it's also the pace that Kentucky would like.
Exactly. Well, Dom Amore, in a few hours, we'll know. Until then, the suspense builds. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan and Kion Wolf, who helped out with today's show, our intern, Skylar Magnoli. We'll be back tomorrow with our salute to spite. And don't forget about Watkinson on Wednesday night.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and my vice presidential Final Four bracket was totally wrong. I had Millard Fillmore beats Walter Mondale, and Aaron Burr beats George Clinton. The musician, not the vice president.